Markets Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A bill awaiting a vote in the state Senate would legalize online sports betting in Wisconsin if it happens through servers physically located on Wisconsin's federally recognized tribal lands.
Last month, the state assembly passed the bill. It now awaits action in the Senate if it's going to reach Governor Evers' desk.
Wisconsin tribal leaders have spoken in favor of the legislation, saying that it would bring in much-needed revenue for the state's tribes.
But on Monday, a trade group representing sportsbook operators like DraftKings and FanDuel had held a press conference to oppose the bill, saying it would give Wisconsin tribes an unfair monopoly over online sports betting.
We'll hear from that group in just a bit. First, we're joined by Nicole Boyd. She is chairwoman of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. She recently spoke in favor of this legislation. Chairwoman Boyd, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Last month, during your State of the Tribes address, you spoke in support of this bill that would legalize online sports betting. Why should lawmakers support this bill?
Thank you for the question. And we are very excited for all of the bipartisan support that this bill is receiving, that all the evidence has been provided, that the state is ready for safer access, that our bettors in Wisconsin deserve protection. I think that the other side being presented is very unfair, and I really appreciate our lawmakers listening to the tribes and all the evidence and data that they are presenting, along with the plans. There's been great investment in all of the work to prepare for this. We are not asking the state for money in addition, so that really makes it a win-win for everyone here in Wisconsin. We are trying to make sure that it is presented in that way.
What do you mean by safer and protections in place? How would this bill do that?
So currently, the markets that people are engaging in, the illegal sports betting markets online, don't have consumer protection regulations. And we want to make sure that that's provided. Tribal gaming can provide that. The state compacts can provide that, along with federal Indian gaming regulation.
How much of a potential financial impact are the tribes looking at if this would become law?
So online sports betting in Wisconsin is a $1 billion market, and none of that money currently is coming to the state. And even bettors are really essentially not getting their fair share in the equation either, with the deals that some of the larger venues are providing them, FanDuel, DraftKings, some of the other big places. And so we really want to make sure that the state can receive their fair share, tribes can receive their fair share. We have compacts that will reflect that. That's the goal.
So we've heard from the Sports Betting Alliance. We'll hear from them in just a moment. But they say that online sports gambling only on tribal servers would be an unfair monopoly. What is your response to that?
This is not their state. That's my primary response, is that tribes have exclusivity of gaming in the state of Wisconsin. And our legislation has recognize that historically and now. And I really think that Wisconsin is doing the right thing and ensuring that tribes are the ones that provide safe and accurate and quality gaming experiences, including online sports betting in our state. This is not their space to come in and monopolize. And tribes can create a wonderful online sports betting experience for our bettors here in the state.
In our final moments together, if this passes the state Senate, if it's signed into law by Governor Evers, how soon would Wisconsin tribes be able to provide legal online sports betting?
Great question. Tribes have been investing millions and millions of dollars and resources in establishing infrastructure for broadband to all 11 of our tribal nations and our lands, from the very southern spaces in Milwaukee all the way to up here in the northernmost point of Wisconsin, where you have your most remote reservation. And so we expect there to be a pretty quick readiness. And like I mentioned, lots of planning and investment has already been done to ensure that we have regulatory framework, staffing capacity, and the benefits plans to know where those additional revenues will be able to support the gaps that we currently have in the public safety services that we need, to for the jobs. So we're ready. We are ready. We expect to be ready once the legislation makes this happen.
Chairwoman Boyd, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Nicole Boyd is chairwoman of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, recently spoke in favor of pending legislation which would legalize online sports betting in Wisconsin with servers hosted on tribal property. For another perspective on the bill, we're joined now by Joe Maloney, president and CEO of Sports Betting Alliance. It's a national trade group representing platforms and apps that offer gambling, including FanDuel and DraftKings. Joe, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Appreciate the time. Good morning.
Good morning. You've spoken out against this bill, saying the legislation would give tribes in Wisconsin an unfair monopoly over online sports betting. Why is that?
We're advocating for an open and competitive marketplace for Wisconsin residents when it comes to legal regulated online sports wagering. The process has been extremely condensed. The number of interested stakeholders that are allowed to participate is remarkably narrow. And the efforts around this resemble backroom dealing,
What
even
do you
just
mean by
the
that?
So just the procession of the process within the legislature and then moving quickly to what is something not even a recorded vote. I mean, Wisconsinites are very much undecided on this. In some polling that we have done and other public polling that we've seen, Wisconsin voters aren't necessarily convinced. And constitutionally, it's pretty clear the language that the public has the opportunity or should have the opportunity to vote on this with regard to any expansion of gaming. And so we're advocating for the voters to have a choice in market design, the voters to have a choice in how legal regulated online sports wagering is platformed. And from there, we can determine the specifics around, how a rising tide can lift all boats for the achievement of the two objectives that I think Chairwoman Boyd articulately explained, which is consumer protection from illegal and unregulated offshore websites, and second, delivering tax revenue to all the state's communities throughout the state.
And just for clarity here, lawmakers did not record individual votes in the assembly. They recorded a voice vote, which is a normal procedure. Currently, Wisconsin allows gambling and sports betting on site at tribal casinos, which has been a really important part of revenue for many tribes here. What do you say to the concern that this would upend that long-standing gaming compact and deal a financial blow to the 11 federally recognized tribes in Wisconsin?
So there's examples throughout the country of national brands and operators such as the ones that I represent that operate in states and in tribal compact states where revenues are dedicated to federally recognized tribes. We've just been shut out of the process, to put it simply. And so we want the opportunity to bring the innovation that we deliver to over 30 states throughout the country. We want the opportunity to compete for consumers in Wisconsin. That competition drives better pricing for consumers in the legal regulated markets. That competition helps drive innovation across any number of important facets when it comes to legal regulated online wagering, such as innovation within betting markets, such as innovation within responsible gaming toolkits and resources. And that competition ultimately is going to drive more tax revenue back to key stakeholders, which absolutely can include tribes. But nobody is saying anyone gets shut out. There's plenty of opportunity, particularly in a sports-crazed state like Wisconsin, for, again, a rising tide to lift all boats. And so it really just comes down to how can legislators in Wisconsin offer voters the opportunity to have visibility into this process and actually have a say?
This legislation, it looks to Florida as a model for how to implement online sports betting. What example should Wisconsin be following instead?
There's ultimately any number of jurisdictions that are in play. There's examples such as Connecticut and Arizona, where priority is absolutely given in the form of tax revenue support and participation to tribal communities and federally recognized tribes. Truly, it is not the job of any of the five online operators to direct the Wisconsin legislature on how to design their own market in a manner that is appropriate for Wisconsin residents. We're simply advocating for the opportunity to compete. And if voters ultimately agree that competition is something that can benefit the voters of their state, we think that's just a question that should be posed to them when it comes to legal, regulated online sports wagering.
But you've said companies like DraftKings and FanDuel could work with tribal casinos in Wisconsin to offer sports betting apps. Why not go that route?
And certainly that is something on the table. Again, our operating companies just have not had the opportunity to advocate. We've got alternative proposals that could seek to achieve this. But unfortunately, again, this has just been a process that's been conducted not in the light of day in Madison. And we're communicating to communities throughout the state that this is potentially something that they should be paying attention to, as it could represent a significant expansion of gaming. And we're operating under the very strong premise that competition is something that can achieve the stated goals when it comes to consumer protection and a maximal amount of tax revenue across the state.
Joe Maloney, alternative proposals. Will the Sports Betting Alliance provide a proposal of a model you think will work in Wisconsin? What is your next step as a trade association?
Yeah, so we've been communicating with a number of stakeholders throughout the House and the Senate, and we're eager to continue that conversation. But again, we're up against, very, very powerful brokers that are seeking to really produce what is ultimately a very narrow marketplace for Wisconsinites when it comes to online sports wagering. And that's why we're communicating right now. There's very few weeks left in the session. There's a prevailing proposal that's moving very, very quickly. And we're trying to do our best to communicate to voters that this is something that they should be concerned about. But again, all options are on the table. Our companies are ready to roll up the sleeves and work with any number of stakeholders that want to platform this in a manner that delivers those consumer protections and that tax revenue.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
Joe Maloney, CEO of Sports Betting Alliance. Earlier, we heard from Nicole Boyd, chairwoman of the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians.
Coming up, Wisconsin has a state Supreme Court election in April. Hear candidate interviews with state Court of Appeals judges running for the open seat, Chris Taylor and Maria Lazar.
I am in this race because I care deeply about the people in our state.
They actually could use a judge or justice like me, who's someone who is calm, judicial, has the experience.
That's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. On April 7th, Wisconsin will elect a new state Supreme Court justice to fill the seat of Rebecca Bradley, who is not seeking re-election.
There are two candidates on the ballot in the officially nonpartisan race. State Appeals Court Judge Maria Lazar, backed by conservatives, and Appeals Court Judge and former Democratic lawmaker Chris Taylor. Liberals currently hold a 4-3 majority on the court, which would become a 5-2 advantage with a Taylor victory.
Both candidates recently sat down with PBS Wisconsin's senior political reporter Zach Schultz to talk about the race and the issues likely to come before the state's highest court. We're going to hear both of those conversations now. Here's Zach with Judge Maria Lazar.
So let's start with your judicial philosophy. How would you describe it, and how does it guide you from the bench?
I describe my philosophy as originalism with a slice of textualism, which means, for those who are not law nerds like me, which means that I look at the documents and the laws as they're written, and I interpret them from that point of view. And if you have to go a little bit outside, I do, but I don't go all the way outside to intent of legislators and things like that.
So obviously this race is now an open seat because Justice Bradley decided not to run again. What was your first thoughts when she announced she was not going to do that?
Well, it was a surprise. My thoughts were that I looked at the last election and I thought that it was so politicized for the people in the state of Wisconsin that I thought they actually could use a judge or justice like me, who's someone who is calm, judicial, has the experience, and will not legislate from the bench.
Has she given you any guidance? Have you reached out to her about what it's like to run for Supreme Court?
I've talked to several of the past justices. I've talked to anyone who will talk to me, and actually more people talk to me than you would think.
How much money is going to be needed to win this race?
I'm not positive on that. I know it will not be anywhere close to last year.
So in what way? How is this different from, I guess, the last two races when control of the court was up for grabs?
Well, that's one thing. I think what I meant by not being anywhere close, I think the numbers were bigger because it would have changed the composition of the court. This time we're talking about a position that is going to be most likely in the minority, but someone who will stand up to be a strong voice for the common sense people of my home state.
So some of the early fundraising totals came out, and you raised about $200,000, your opponent close to $2 million. Some people raised their eyebrows at that, but you got into this race after her, and you're trying to, I guess, fight your way into a kind of an oxygen-starved environment when it comes to fundraising. So what's it been like for you?
Well, that's true. So I started on October 1. So I think the numbers actually are relatively good for starting that late. Also, since January, which was the cutoff date, January 1, we've had a big groundswell of support from people who've recognized and actually heard about this race and realized there is no primary. And they've looked at it and they've said, this is a race and a candidate they're interested in supporting.
So when you look at the last two elections, has that impacted morale for the number of people paying attention to this race, or perhaps for people getting behind your campaign and seeing, well, the last two conservative candidates lost in rather large fashion?
I don't know if it's impacted morale. What I will say is this. I think that the state of Wisconsin is looking at these races and they're asking who's running and why people are running and for what reason. And when I look at this race, the reason I am running is because I want to be someone on that court who represents the law for the state of Wisconsin. I want to be someone who is their voice, bringing diversity of thought and judicial backgrounds and experience to that court. I don't look at those past races as anything indicative of what's going to happen. In fact, I'm kind of hoping that there's going to be a line in the sand drawn now where we can look forward and say, who's the better judicial candidate? Who has more experience? And I think in this race, it's pretty clear that that's my candidacy.
When you compare the records of the two candidates here, you're both circuit court judges. You're both now in the appellate court. So how do you explain to the public the difference in your background?
Well, numbers. Numbers are the reason. So I spent 20 years in private practice. I spent 5 years at the Department of Justice representing the state of Wisconsin. But I spent 7 years on the circuit court in every branch, criminal, civil, juvenile, mental commitments. My opponent spent 2 years in criminal. I've spent 4 years on the Court of Appeals, published many written opinions. My opponent has spent 2. I think when you add up the numbers, it's pretty clear who has the judicial and legal experience.
Obviously, there's a pretty high-profile race for governor also kicking off right now. When we talk about that oxygen starvation of people paying attention, how do you cut through to let people know, hey, this race is really important?
Well, you're right. So my race is April 7th, and all the other races are in November. I think since I've been on the circuit court and the Court of Appeals, I have continually gone to my 12 counties and anywhere else, including Milwaukee, to talk to people, to talk to high school kids, college kids, about the courts, about why it's so important. And I do that all the time. So I think this is just a continuation of telling people why this race is so important. It's in April because it's nonpartisan, and it's in April because that's how Wisconsin the legislature has determined it should be.
We've seen in the past couple of races, candidates talk more about their own personal values versus issues. And that's a change compared to races in prior decades. How are you talking about your values versus issues? And what does that mean to the public when they're listening and they want to hear maybe more clues to what you actually feel or how you might rule, even though that's obviously not what you're supposed to be talking about?
So you mentioned two things that are really important. So how I might rule is never an issue, and no judge, no justice, no candidate should ever say that. But we've looked at the rules, and we've looked at the ethical rules, and we've determined that it's possible to tell the state of Wisconsin more information about where I stand, what I stand up for, and what issues I believe are important, and how I view the law, how I interpret the law, what my philosophies are. So on my website, you can go there, judgemarialazar.com. You can go there, and it has my positions on important issues that are set there, written in black and white, so people can see it, can see what I stand for. I don't say how I will rule on a case, but I say what I believe is important.
Is that frustrating when you speak to people that are potentially voters who they want to hear more? They want to hear you talk like a politician because they think of these races more political as opposed to an independent judicial race.
They do. And in some respects, I'll go places where there will be politicians speaking, and it's always that interesting dichotomy between the calm demeanor of a judge versus the politician who's yelling at the room and screaming at everybody. But I think that's what people want. They want their judges not to be someone who's yelling with their hair on fire in the room. They want someone they think they would like to have adjudicate their cases. So when I go and talk to people, I explain to them that I can't tell them how I'll rule on case A versus B. But I do tell them, here's how I rule. Here's how I respect people in my court. Here's what I think of victims' rights. Those sort of things, I think that gets across to people. They recognize that there are certain limits and that we're bound by those limits, or we should be.
When it comes to precedent, you've mentioned a couple of times that if you win, you would be in the minority.
Yes.
But that's not a forever thing. As we've seen, the court can change. What is the standard when it comes to overruling precedent?
Well, so people have to understand that precedent means that you don't, just because the court changes composition, you don't necessarily go back and then revisit things you've just done. Precedent is that you respect, you give stare decisis. It's a credit and it's a benefit to cases that have been done, and you give them time to maybe err, to be looked at. When courts have overturned precedent, the U.S. Supreme Court in general, it's something that's maybe 20, 30 years down the road. It's not something that they just do willy-nilly, as Scalia would say. It's something that you have to have seen that it doesn't work. You can't just say, I'm now the member of the majority, so everything that was done, I get to undo. That's not how courts work. We need to restore the respect and integrity in those courts and have them move forward and not always be looking back to things that they want to change.
And finally, will you seek Donald Trump's endorsement? We saw Brad Schimmel go out and ask for that towards the end of his campaign.
I'm not seeking endorsements of anyone who's out of the state of Wisconsin. If someone looks at my campaign and they agree with my vision, my idea that we need to restore justice and integrity to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, I would welcome the discussion, but I'm not seeking anything.
All right. Judge Lazar, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
That is Judge Maria Lazar, candidate for State Supreme Court, talking with PBS Wisconsin political reporter Zach Schultz.
Zach also talked to Lazar's opponent, Appeals Court Judge Chris Taylor. Here's a listen.
Let's start with your judicial philosophy. Tell me how you came by it and how it impacts you when you're on the bench.
Well, in every case, I'm guided by the same things. I'm guided by a desire to do justice for the people who are in front of me. I'm guided by a obligation to apply the law as fairly and as consistently as possible. And then I'm also obligated to hold those who violate the law accountable, regardless of who they are or how powerful they are. So those are really the three principles that guide my decisions in cases.
So you've been in this race for a while, and originally your opponent was going to be the incumbent Justice Rebecca Bradley. What was your reaction when she decided not to run again?
You know, my focus really is on the people of the state of Wisconsin, regardless of who my opponent is. I am in this race because I care deeply about the people in our state. They deserve a justice and a court that is going to stand up for their rights and protect their freedoms. And they deserve a court that is going to make sure that the other branches of government are held accountable, including the federal government, when they overreach into the independence of our state. So I'm very focused on getting to the people, talking with the people. My approach doesn't change based on who I'm running against. This is a campaign about the people of the state of Wisconsin. I'm going to be a justice for the people of the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, building off that, then, you don't see a big difference between Rebecca Bradley and Maria Lazar, your opponent now?
You know, I think they're very similar in a lot of ways. They have very extreme positions that are out of touch with the people of Wisconsin. On reproductive health care, my opponent Maria Lazar celebrated the overturning of Roe versus Wade. She has made comments that she would have enforced an 1849 criminal ban that would have outlawed abortion in almost every instance. She has made comments that she thinks a six-week abortion ban would be a good thing, signaling to the legislature that this might be a law that she would be okay with as a judge. So those things indicate that she cannot be counted on to protect rights and freedoms of Wisconsinites, and she wants to take us backwards. I want to take the state and the people of the state forward.
Given the last couple of races we've seen in Wisconsin, how much money do you think it's going to take to win this race?
You know, I'm hoping not as much as what we have seen. It has gotten ridiculous how much money are in these races. And when I was in the legislature, I fought against the erosion of our campaign finance laws. The reality is here in Wisconsin, we have very little laws that prevent these out-of-state billionaires and big money special interests from coming into this race. They're going to be coming in to support my opponent. That is how she got elected to the Court of Appeals. These same right-wing billionaires that we saw last April have supported her in the past.
The first fundraising numbers that came out showed you with a commanding lead in fundraising. Is there a danger that some of your supporters may think, oh, this race is over?
I hope not, because this race is not over. We are right in the thick of it. I take nothing for granted. I worked very hard to get out in all corners of the state. And, of course, my campaign worked very hard to raise the resources that I would need out of my, I think, 19,000 campaign contributions. 15,000 of those are $100 or less. So I am receiving a lot of support from the people of the state of Wisconsin. That contrasts with my opponent. Her average campaign donation was $1,800, and she only had 16 donations that were $100 or less. So she's clearly getting her support and will continue to do so from the billionaires, from the big corporations. I'm going to the people and asking for their support, because this race is about them.
Unlike the last couple of races, this one's not going to likely determine the majority on the bench. Does that run the risk that this flies under the radar for some people because they don't feel the stakes are as high?
I mean, I don't think so, because the majority on this court can be changed on a dime. We have five state Supreme Court elections coming up. And so just because there's now a pro-democracy majority on this court by only one vote does not lessen the importance of this court. And when we have so many elections coming up, there's four more state Supreme Court elections coming up after mine. No one should take anything for granted. This court can change very quickly. But if I am able to get elected, there will be a pro-democracy majority on the court until at least 2030.
A couple of years ago, when Janet Protasiewicz won her race, she kind of changed the game in terms of talking as a candidate about her values versus issues and making sure to stay away from how she would decide, but explaining to voters, this is what I care about, this is what I'm passionate about. How do you approach talking about your values or issues?
Well, I think it's really important that voters see who I am. And they deserve that. They are electing me to a 10-year term to the highest court in our state. So I am very open about what my values are. You know, I value every person's ability to make their own personal private health care decisions. My opponent does not. She has stated that. That is not a value that she has. I value courts protecting people's rights and freedoms and holding people and entities accountable when they violate our law and violate our Constitution. My opponent has shown that she is a rubber stamp for the most powerful and the right-wing extremists in the decisions that she has issued. And so I think it's really fair game for the public to know these things are things we value.
How do you approach precedent? Because we've seen, as the court shifted majorities over the last few years, a number of cases looking at old cases that had been settled in the past, Mark Lyne being one of those. But in that category, what would you do to when you approach a precedent decision?
Well, first of all, you have to look at, does the precedential case violate the Constitution? Does it protect or take away people's rights? So that is the first thing that I would look at. Secondly, I think if it is an issue that involves in constitutional rights, you look at, well, has this been in place for a long period of time such that people have relied on these protections, like Roe versus Wade? It's a perfect example. The Dobbs case took away rights that American women and Wisconsin women had come to depend on over the last 50 years throughout the duration of my life. And so that was very alarming that it was so flippantly done, 50 years of precedent. Again, that conflicts my opinion about Roe versus Wade, conflicts with my opponent who celebrated the reversal of Roe versus Wade. So what I look at, though, in looking at precedent is, did this case comport with constitutional protections or did it not? So there's appropriate cases where precedent should be overturned. I mean, look at Plessy versus Ferguson, the separate but equal. We all know that is wrong. And thankfully, there was a case that overturned that type of discrimination in Brown versus Board of Education.
You're running for a Wisconsin Supreme Court position, but how much of what's happening nationally and President Trump's impact will overshadow this race as voters take all of that into account when they're making their choices at the ballot box?
Well, look, I think that we have an incredible opportunity in this race, the people of the state of Wisconsin, to elect a justice who is going to stand up for their rights, for their freedoms, who is going to hold the federal government accountable when they overreach into the state. And I'm going to protect the independence of Wisconsin. We are an independent state. We have our own constitution, our own laws, and everyone is subject to those when they come in the state of Wisconsin. So I will be a strong justice, making sure our people are protected and our state is protected.
All right. Judge Taylor, thanks for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That was Judge Chris Taylor talking with PBS Wisconsin's Zach Schultz. Earlier, we heard his conversation with conservative-backed candidate Maria Lazar. The two face off in the April 7th election for an open seat on the state Supreme Court.
Coming up, a shipwrecked luxury liner in Lake Michigan is found after a 60-year search. It's a window into Midwestern history.
The Lac La Belle is a time capsule. It's an underwater museum from 1872, and it played such a pivotal role in Milwaukee's history and Grand Haven's history.
Meet shipwreck hunters. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. A shipwreck hunting group announced recently they discovered the wreckage of the Lac La Belle, a luxury steamer that sank in Lake Michigan more than 150 years ago. It was found about 20 miles offshore between Racine and Kenosha.
Scuba diver Paul Ehorn has been searching for shipwrecks since he was a teenager. This discovery was nearly 60 years in the making.
According to UW-Madison's Wisconsin Water Library, the Great Lakes, they're home to an estimated 6,000 to 10,000 shipwrecks, most of which remain undiscovered.
But underwater archaeologists say shipwreck discoveries in the Great Lakes are on the rise because of advancements in technology and with the help of citizen scientists.
Brendan Baylod is a maritime historian and president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. His book on Wisconsin shipwrecks is called Fathoms Deep But Not Forgotten. Brendan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Paul Ehorn is an Illinois-based scuba diver and shipwreck hunter. He has located 15 Great Lakes shipwrecks, most recently the Lac La Belle. Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you, too.
Paul, this search for the Lac La Belle, it has been decades in the making. What was it like to finally locate this wreck you've been looking for so long?
Well, it was quite intriguing. I had a friend with me, and he'd never been along when we discovered a wreck, and he was real excited. It was just a wonderful day. Beautiful wreck, it turned out, and it's just got a beautiful name, La Belle, you know. It was fun.
You found it within hours. Why was it the actual find once you got to it not that difficult?
Well, Brendan had a lot of information in his book, and I'd done a lot of research and put the two together, and it took us just a little less than 2 hours to find it, and we knew it was the same wreck. Had a sonar printout. We put a drop camera down, which was pretty much a camera on an eyeball on a string, looking downward. You can't control it. It just kind of swings which way it wants to, or the current carries it. But we got a little peek at the wreck anyway with that, just black and white, nothing super, but just something to make you a little more satisfied.
Something to whet your appetite, right? Brendan, you know, eyeball on a string, what goes into the search for a shipwreck?
Well, I mean, really, you make a search grid. And I think, and Paul may want to speak to this too, but we usually figure out an area that we can do in a couple of days. And what we want to do is we want to rule out that bottom. We want to say, this is where it isn't, rather than this is where it is. Because that's good information too. It's important information. And we go out and mow the lawn. You know, Paul's got a really good commercial-grade side-scanning sonar made by Klein, and it'll shoot a three-dimensional picture of the bottom that's like a third of a mile wide or more. And, you know, we go out and we just mow that area, and we wait for something to crawl across the screen.
Wow. Wow. Paul, how do you decide when and how to alert the authorities and the public about a located wreck? Because Lac La Belle, that was located in 2022.
Well, it was located on October 4th, which was late in the year for the Great Lakes. It gets very choppy and winds blow and just cold. You don't want to go out there. You can't go out there quite often. Then 2024, I got two divers to join me, John Jansen and John Scholes. They're deep divers, and I enlisted them, and we finally got together, organized everything. We got out there, and the two Johns went down and filmed it.
Brendan, you and other underwater archaeologists say that we're seeing more shipwreck discoveries on the Great Lakes. What is contributing to this uptick in locating old sunken ships?
I think it's really three things. The first thing is better awareness. People see these press releases that we do when we find new wrecks, because we're trying to educate the public about the Great Lakes maritime history and about the role these ships played in building America back in the 1800s. And we're having a lot of success. People are learning about it. The other two factors, number one, I'd say, is the cost of technology going down. So side-scanning sonar used to be, you know, like units like the one Paul used, really were the realm of universities and corporations. But now side-scanning sonar is coming down in price to where it's affordable by a serious hobbyist. And then lastly, I'd say that a lot of wrecks are being found because the water cleared up due to the zebra and quagga mussels. And you can see the shipwrecks from the surface now in 20, 30 feet of water. So a lot of discoveries are being made by paddleboarders and kayakers who are reporting those finds. So it's kind of the golden age, I guess you might say, of shipwreck discovery on the Great Lakes, and a tremendous opportunity for us to tell the stories of these ships that played such a huge role in the cultural history of the Midwest and Wisconsin in particular.
Why are those invasive quagga mussels both a blessing and a curse?
Well, Lake Michigan naturally should have between 5 and 10 feet of visibility, right? And when I started scuba diving, and I think Paul can really speak to this, you know, he started diving in 1964. you know, the visibility down there, we called it braille diving. You'd go down and you'd have to get within a couple of feet of the shipwreck. Now you go down there and you can see, you know, sometimes 50, 80, 100 feet. You can see the whole ship. You know, it's spawned this all these beautiful underwater photos of these shipwrecks and raised consciousness. But at the same time, our biomass has collapsed in Lake Michigan because, you know, the zebra mussels filter all the zooplankton out of the water column, and then small forage species that eat those are decimated. And we're starting to see, you know, some real impact, particularly the whitefish population. It's completely changed Lake Michigan's biome.
We're talking about shipwreck hunting with Brendan Baylaud there, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, and Paul Ehorn, a scuba diver and shipwreck hunter who recently discovered Lac La Belle in Lake Michigan after it sank more than 150 years ago. Paul, you've been scuba diving and hunting shipwrecks since you were 15 years old. What's behind your lifelong fascination with the Great Lakes and this piece of history?
A program in the 1950s called Sea Hunt on the TV, starring Mike Nelson. And I got my first shipwreck in 1964, I believe. And I was a skinny kid of about 120 pounds in a homemade wetsuit. Well, I bought it in the Monkey Ward catalog for $28. You glued it together. It was a kit. Came with a can of glue, and it kind of slowed the flow of water. It didn't keep you warm, I know that. But I would go in this old sidewheel boat that had burned and called the Niagara, and I was down there. It was early spring, the water's cold, probably the low 40s, and I came up and just shivering uncontrollably, and I'm sat there, and all I could say was, "How long before we can go back in?" You know, you have to do a little surface interval in between dives, so you avoid the bends. And I was hooked. That was it. It became a passion, an obsession, insanity. Your life just, it takes over.
Well, Brendan, let's dig into the history with the Lac La Belle. It's almost like a time capsule of the year it sank, 1872. How can these shipwrecks help us better understand the history of the region and of that era?
Well, she was part of a boom of vessels that were being built right at the end of the Civil War. And if you know anything about the Great Lakes region, we were the industrial engine that powered the industrialization of America, the raw goods that were being used, not just to build our country, but to fight the Civil War, the copper that was being used, you know, was all coming out of the Lake Superior mines and being carried by this ship. And back in those days, there was no such thing as a passenger ship versus a package freight ship. They all did double duty. So the Lac La Belle was really an opulent, fancy passenger steamer. She'd carry hundreds and hundreds of people from Cleveland, Ohio, up to the Lake Superior mining communities because that was big business back then. And on the way back, they would load her full of copper ingots. And she'd carry those down. And that went in to fuel really so many parts of the industrialization of America. And later, when she was moved down to the Lake Michigan trade, she was carrying a ton of trade back and forth between Milwaukee and Grand Haven. So these vessels, you know, in no small way, really were responsible for building America. And that, you know, it's so rare to have a structure on land from 1864 that contains everything on it, let alone one that has everything on it the day that that people were last on it. And the Lac La Belle is a time capsule. It's an underwater museum from 1872, and it played such a pivotal role, you know, not just in the industrialization of America, but in Milwaukee's history, in Grand Haven's history. You know, it's hard to really understate the importance that these ships and these port cities played in American, you know, in developing our country.
How did she go down? How did she sink?
Well, she was on her usual route across the lake, but it was late season. It was October. She was not carrying a whole lot of passengers at that point because it was considered a rough time of year to cross. But, you know, these ships ran late into the season.
Into November as well.
Yeah. That's right. And so she was on her usual route. She got a couple hours out of Milwaukee, almost heading straight across the lake, when she was found to be leaking. And they didn't know exactly why she was leaking. They turned her back, tried to turn her around, and water started to board her. The waves really came up. You know, you didn't have weather forecasting back then like we do now. So she's in about 10 to 15 foot waves, which should have been something she could have handled. But with her leaking, she started to slowly sink in the water, and it put her boiler fires out. This was a steam-powered vessel, and so if you see the movie Titanic, you picture the coal men down below shoveling coal into the boilers, and those doors are pretty low down. Water got in, and then she was at the mercy of the storm. She's getting real low in the water. The waves are getting bigger and bigger. And around 5 a.m, the captain gives the order. He sees that she's going to go down, and they all take to the lifeboats. And in these huge seas that are building out there, one of the lifeboats capsizes, sending 8 people to their death. But everyone else made it ashore. The lifeboats all came ashore at different points along the Wisconsin coast, which is a bit of a clue as to where she might have been. The rest is history. They went and reported the wreck to the newspapers. There are a lot of different accounts from different people. She was a major, major loss that year, and a huge loss to the Engelmann Transportation Company. Really one of the finest passenger steamers on Lake Michigan at the time.
Thank you for that history. Paul, you know, the Lac La Belle, it was such a big find. What's next for you? Where do you go from here?
Well, I have 2 or 3 left that have drawn interest, but they've drawn interest by probably 15 different people or groups. There's a lot of smaller ones, but I like wooden vessels. I like steamers. Well, I like schooners also, but I prefer a steamer and a wooden steamer, and this was the best of both worlds. So. Mm-hmm.
Brendan, before we have to let you go, the Wisconsin Shipwreck Coast National Marine Sanctuary, created nearly 5 years ago, you know, to protect these types of sites. And I'm wondering, I think this wreck is outside of that sanctuary, but how does a national sanctuary designation protect these shipwrecks for future generations?
Well, I think the wrecks already had legal protection for the most part, for many years here in Wisconsin. The sanctuary's primary mission is really to teach people about the history and to promote shipwreck tourism in the four communities that it covers: Port Washington, Sheboygan, Manitowoc, and Two Rivers. And they have a huge concentration of wrecks there. And one of the big draws there is the tourism, because you can go out and paddleboard and kayak and see these shipwrecks. Or if you're a scuba diver, you can go out and dive on them.
So how do you make sure that the Lac La Belle stays intact and protected for years and years to come?
I think that may take care of itself in some ways, because it's not a casual dive. The number of people that can safely dive a wreck at that depth isn't huge, but those divers tend to be pretty responsible. I don't think that the big risk to these wrecks anymore is scuba divers. It's natural forces. It's quagga mussels. And so all of our wrecks on the Great Lakes have a shelf life. You know, they're not going to look like this in 100 years. I have to commend Paul for really wanting to do that photogrammetry model, because that's a good standard for recording exactly how that wreck, was at the time he found it. That way we can see they do change over time, and we get a snapshot in time of that underwater museum and exactly what it looked like. So, I have to commend him for really spending the time to do that.
Well, Paul and Brendan, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for having us.
That is scuba diver and shipwreck hunter Paul E. Horn and Brendan Baylod, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. We've been talking about the recent discovery of the Lac La Belle in Lake Michigan off the coast between Kenosha and Racine, and what's behind the recent rise in shipwreck discoveries.
And a note for this weekend, the 2026 Ghost Ships Festival takes place in Manitowoc. It'll feature presentations about shipwrecks, nautical archaeology, and maritime history. Learn more at ghostshipsfestival.com. In an upcoming show, we'll take a look at work requirements for certain people who use federal food assistance and how that's being put into practice here in Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you. Do you or a loved one use that food aid? With those new requirements in place, has there been additional difficulties in receiving that aid? Do you have questions about how that's supposed to work?
And on a wider note, whether you receive that sort of federal food aid or not, are you having trouble dealing with the cost of food lately?
Share your story or your questions. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch. That number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.